I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The last Republican debate before the South Carolina primary started with an angry Newt Gingrich who took offense at the moderator's first question. CNN's John King asked Gingrich to respond to allegations by Gingrich's second wife that he wanted an open marriage while he was having an affair with a woman who would become his third wife.
I think the destructive, vicious, negative nature of much of the news media makes it harder to govern this country, harder to attract decent people to run for public office, and I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that.
The audience ate it up, and Gingrich wasn't done with his critique of the media.
Every person in here knows personal pain. Every person in here has had someone close to them go through painful things. To take an ex-wife and make it 2 days before the primary a significant question in a presidential campaign is as close to despicable as anything I can imagine.
Gingrich, Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, and Rick Santorum sparred for the next 2 hours over jobs, capitalism, immigration, abortion, tax returns, health care, defense spending, and leadership. Joining us from South Carolina is Neil King. He's national reporter for The Wall Street Journal, has been covering the Republican presidential race. And Neil King, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure, Marty.
And Scott Huffman is with us as well, professor of political science at Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where he also directs the Winthrop Poll Initiative. And Scott, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And let me begin with you, Scott, if I could. Was that a legitimate question to start off a debate last night?
Well, the question is whether or not he should have started with it. You know, most people might watch the beginning of the debate and then flip to something else later. And if that's all they got, then that debate definitely seemed like Newt Gingrich won, and his performance in the rest of the debate wasn't that great. So if he ends up winning South Carolina by the barest of margins, the campaign might have to send John King a thank you gift. When, you know, character is brought up through the course of multiple of the candidates' campaigns, and they've been taking shots at Gingrich on character, it really had to come up at some point, whether or not it should have been brought up as the first thing and whether or not it should have been taken on so directly is another question. But it looked like Gingrich had that answer in the can and ready to pull it out and use it at any moment. And the fact that he got to use it while anybody who was watching the debate, almost everyone who would tune in for a few minutes was watching that exchange, really probably helped him. The cheers, very interesting thing. The debate was, you know, co-sponsored by the Tea Party Patriots, a Tea Party group, and they all the people from that group tend to sit on one side, but it was more near the microphone, so the cheers whenever the media was derided was not uniform across the auditorium, although it probably sounded and appeared that way if you were watching on TV.
What did you make of that first question, Neil King?
It's funny, I just could listen to his response over and over because just from the kind of looking at it as a rhetorical study or the study of timing and bombast, I mean, it's just so brilliant the way that Gingrich is able to do these things. It's, you know, whether it was thought up in advance or not, it was just so well put with just the right pauses and so on. He is so good at this particular thing, and, you know, they give him the debate stage, and for the most part, he runs away with it, no matter what the merits of the argument are. And, you know, the funny thing is for it to come up first like that, though he derided it in the most extreme kind of language, it was perfect for his purposes, because all of us sitting there covering it, we have very tight deadlines. It was one of the, you know, we've now watched 17 or 18 of these debates.
Right.
Most of the time we're fishing like, oh my God, what are we going to write our stories about? And it's like, wow, here's a gift. Right in the first 5 minutes we have like what was by far the, you know, the high point of the debate, and everyone kind of began writing their stories right then. So I'm sure that across the country that exchange was on everybody's front pages in the morning. I think, you know, that helps Newt Gingrich.
Well, and I have to apologize to our listeners because we played the clips that I'm sure people have heard untold times already today. But would you say, Neil King, and I do want to talk beyond just that very first question, how would you say Newt Gingrich did for the rest of the debate?
I think he did all right. He took some definite hits. I mean, there, I thought Romney had some great moments, and, you know, it's hard to ever spend time on the trail with Newt Gingrich where he doesn't talk to strange, sometimes excruciating length about his time with Ronald Reagan, and he loves to talk about it as though he was sitting around with Margaret Thatcher all the time. And when Mitt Romney then brought up this great thing about how he had gone through all of Ronald Reagan's diaries and only found one mention of Newt Gingrich, and it was for him bringing up an idea that Ronald Reagan then quickly dismissed as dumb, was just a great put down. And there were a number of those actually throughout the evening, coming from Santorum or others. He took a lot of blows. But, you know, I also think that his debate performance last Monday and a variety of other things are just giving him some strong momentum that I'm sure Scott Huffman and others have seen in the, you know, last few days polling that's made this race really tight all of a sudden.
Well, and Scott, let me go back to you and actually go back to Rick Santorum. And I've been saying for the last couple of times we've been doing shows about the GOP primary race is why Santorum hasn't done better. And clearly he's starting to do better. But one of the things that he said to Newt Gingrich, and this is a quote here, "I served with him. I was there. This was obviously in Congress. I knew what problems were going on in the House of Representatives, and Newt Gingrich was leading there. It was an idea, a minute, no discipline, no ability to pull things together. I understand you're taking credit for the 1994 election, and you did have a lot of plans." And he goes on to say that basically he was grandiose and chaotic. Does this stuff stick, do you think, Scott?
If it hadn't been for that first exchange with Newt Gingrich that we're all talking about, that may have been one of the leads of the story. I think now, you know, the lead is that first exchange, and then Romney actually doing pretty well defending his time at Bain, although he had some awkward moments over his tax reforms. But those comments from Rick Santorum cut bone, and there were parts of the auditorium where you could hear audible gasps and murmurs of assent and people saying, yeah, you know, and it really did hit home. It cut bone, and Newt Gingrich was, you know, really hit by that. And his performance after that was good. It wasn't as good as his performance up front, but it fell off, and those body blows really did hit home. But a lot of that will be lost.
Well, and that goes back, Neil, to the bank scandal of the 1990s. I'm not sure how many people in the audience were aware of that, but it was a pretty big scandal at the time.
Yeah, it was. I think overall, I mean, not to go into the distant history part of this, but the attack that Santorum, kind of the heart of it, was making and made in other ways throughout last night's debate, and one that Mitt Romney has hit on for weeks and months, is just this whole argument that Newt Gingrich is a combustible, sort of unreliable, undisciplined, you know, megalomaniac kind of character. They're one of the great moments in the debate, actually, but one that nobody viewing would have known was when all of us who were writing about the thing suddenly got in our inboxes this email from the Romney campaign that was this hysterical compendium going back decades of all of these just grandiose things that Newt Gingrich has said, comparing himself to Pericles and, you know, Abraham Lincoln, and it was just a great roster of outlandish quotes, because he's just so good at those. He is a master of hyperbole. He really does deeply believe that he's a, you know, profoundly important figure in the conservative movement, and they really, really hit strongly on the whole grandiose thing, which he in the end actually ended up using that word.
Yeah, I noticed
so,
that.
You know, that's a big theme that all of his rivals have been picking on, and it's one of the reasons, to be honest, that the Democrats would love to see him become the nominee.
Well, and Scott, once again, you've got Ron Paul saying, "But what about me?"
Yeah, there were several times where the Ron Paul supporters in the crowd, and I was actually sitting in a section where I was surrounded by them, were shouting for him to get more time. Several of the questions on, for example, abortion and health care, you know, the moderator was almost going to move past and ignore Ron Paul, and Ron Paul saying, you know, "I'm a doctor. I provided health care. I thought you were, you know, biased against military veterans and doctors here by not giving me time." And Ron Paul was Ron Paul. Ron Paul, did the guest appearance of himself last night. He put in the exact performance his supporters wanted to hear. And he was less of a factor in the debate, though, simply because he was not given as many opportunities as the other folks on the stage.
And why do you think that is, Neil?
You know, Ron Paul is such a fascinating figure, and every morning I wake up to emails from various of his outraged readers when they read our stories about the debate and why did we leave out Ron Paul or not give him his due. And you know, I think his presence on the stage at these debates is kind of incomparable, and we'll never really see the likes of it because he's willing to just stand by these positions, many of which are really profoundly unpopular in the Republican Party, particularly his foreign policy positions. But, you know, they are his principles, and that's what he is all about. But the difficult thing for a reporter and for us dealing with it is that he is not only is he not going to become the nominee, and it's, you can make that case pretty much mathematically, but it's not really even his intention. He knows that himself, and he's said it himself. His desire is to modify and alter the Republican Party and have the leverage to do that. And so he's going to fight this all the way through June and go to the convention and hope to have enough delegates to change the platform and to alter their views about the Federal Reserve and various things like that. So it's a hard thing to cover in some ways, and it's one of the reasons that he is sort of marginalized in the debates and in our coverage, is that his is a bigger kind of movement and campaign that's more sort of tectonic, but it's not really, in the end, realistically about getting, you know, him to be the nominee and him to become president, because I think he himself has acknowledged even the last few weeks that that's not going to happen.
Neil, let me ask you what you think of the debates themselves. And I have to say, I cringed last night when I listened to that CNN opening and the sort of Michael Bay type Hollywood music, the drum, you know, the deep bass notes and the names that are given to the candidates.
You know, I think the evolution of these debates has actually been one of the most fascinating things of the last year. And I, you know, now that we all comment through Twitter and stuff like that,
sure.
I was at one point tweeting last night saying, you know, remember when Jim Lehrer in the old days would, like, turn to the audience and say, now we're glad you're all here, and I know you all have your own positions, but let's hold your applause, let's hold your, you know, let's, basically it was like you're at a tennis match or something like that.
Exactly.
Now, these debates, not only have they turned into hockey matches, but, like, what one thing you didn't, nobody would have seen unless they were there and Scott was there, is that beforehand a CNN guy, almost sort of like stand-up comic, came out and was pumping up the crowd, and they were even doing, like, practice applause, and he was saying that hecklers would be thrown out, but they want this audience participation. And in the debate on Monday, which was really a raucous debate, a lot of the folks had been to various kind of like cocktail parties in advance. It started at 9. A lot of people, I'm not saying they were all drunk, but there was, I think, a little bit of liquor in the crowd. And that was a really heavy audience participation. We've now had two debates in a row with standing ovations. We've never seen that in debate history. And it's just the whole, this debate as entertainment has just really taken over, and they have become highly entertaining. Those four people last night, I would argue, are the best four debaters on a debate stage that we've ever seen in probably American political history, because they're so practiced at this, seasoned, and as Santorum himself is saying, I'm now among the final four. It's like, you know, like a basketball tournament.
Exactly. Well, I want to put the same question to you, Scott Huffman, but we have to take a short break first. Talking with Scott Huffman and Neil King about last night's debate in South Carolina, talking about the race for the White House and the GOP primary coming up tomorrow in South Carolina. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents Comic Catharsis, a gift of cartoons by William Steig. The creator of Shrek, Steig achieved fame for his thousands of cartoons, New Yorker magazine covers, and his humorous observations on human relationships. Comic Catharsis at the Brandywine River Museum is on view now through March 11th. Details online at brandywinemuseum.org.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
You may remember us from WHYY's last membership drive.
If you had access to YStream, then you missed out on all our witty banter.
And if you'd like to miss out on it again, you can.
Act now and pledge for YStream. It's WHYY-FM without the pledge break.
That's right, Ed, but this offer won't last.
The last day to sign up for this thank you gift is January 29th. For details, visit whyy.org/YStream.
The dust has settled in Iowa and New Hampshire. Now, the Republican presidential candidates are focused on their next battleground.
We're going to take to South Carolina.
The good people of South Carolina.
On to South Carolina!
I'm Guy Raz. Join us tomorrow for the latest results, reactions from the campaigns, and expert analysis. Live coverage of the South Carolina primary from NPR News.
Tomorrow night at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking in this hour of Radio Times about the Republican presidential primary with Scott Huffman, a professor of political science at Winthrop University. That's in Rock Hill, South Carolina, where he also directs the Winthrop Poll Initiative. Also with us is Neil King, national reporter for the Wall Street Journal, has been covering the Republican presidential race. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9400. Scott, same question to you that I asked to Neil before the break about these debates and just whether it's good television or not, or does it help the process or not? What do you think?
Well, I think it helps ratings is the main thing. That intro that you referenced for the debate was a real groaner. It seemed like a parody of a movie trailer as the voiceover comes in and literally says, "The battle for the South." and you know, and it gave little storylines for each of the people that you were to follow. And we have had so many of these that you're not seeing, you know, real intellectual exchanges. It has sort of gotten to this, you know, this gotcha moment. It reminds me of, you know, some of the Japanese TV game shows you see where, you know, people are falling into lakes and getting, you know, hit by giant balls. We're waiting to see, you know, who's going to come crashing down and who can bound triumphantly into the final circle there. And there's not a lot of information that comes out of these. It's more about who got whom, and that's entertainment. That's not informing the voters.
Scott, I know I've asked you this before, but things seem to get pretty rough and tumble when a primary moves to South Carolina. Can you give us the answer to that question again?
Whether they'll get rough and tumble?
No, I say, why does it get rough and tumble in South Carolina?
Right.
I think I asked you this about a month ago.
Yeah, South Carolina has a real history of this. It goes back when we were a one-party state. You know, the Democrats controlled everything. They were the party of white supremacy. Their Republicans often didn't even run for, you know, governor or senate or U.S. House. And so the only way to differentiate yourself from the other candidates was to eviscerate them personally. I mean, there was a lot of demagoguery going on. And then when the Republicans became relevant and became more of a two-party state, they would duke it out. And they kind of took the mantle for that. And now that we're Republican dominant, you know, all of the players who were relevant there in the beginning, you know, starting with Lee Atwater, left a legacy of just rough and tumble politics. It has been less behind the scenes sneaky dirty this time. There have been a few of those whisper campaigns and flyers under windshields like before. However, a lot of the dirty laundry has been able to be slung on the lines in public with the super PACs. And so people are saying, you know what, those dirty politics, they only got a few people knowing these secrets or hearing about this mud with whisper campaigns and calls are not as effective as the new media we're able to use. And so it is more publicly dirty, but less dirty tricks, if that makes sense.
It actually does. And is the TV just littered with these ads?
I think the term littered is absolutely beautifully accurate on every level. They really are. The ad buys have been going crazy. All the campaigns have been, let me phrase that, campaigns and especially the super PACs, which are absolutely unconnected to the campaigns at all, have been dumping money into South Carolina. We have been seeing it everywhere. The flyers, I get multiple flyers in the mail every day, glossy, beautifully done stuff, and you cannot pick up the phone without hearing a click and hanging up because it's illegal for the robocalls to, you know, keep going if a human picks it up. But if you're away at work, you come home to 17 messages sent out to you. So it's everywhere.
Is it the battle of the super PACs, Neil?
It is. I mean, it really has changed the complexion of these races in ways that I'm not sure if we should all be particularly comfortable with. Because, you know, not only have we come to a position where only the debaters, the people that really excel at debating, can any longer contemplate running for president, which didn't used to be the case. But now it's sort of only those who also can summon, you know, the big name, big dollar support to have, you know, like if the campaign itself is a ground, you know, army, this is like a huge air force, and it's the size of whoever can have the biggest air force funded by, you know, the most deep-pocketed donors. And if you look at Newt Gingrich, I mean, he was having trouble putting any ads on the air, and then one, you know, casino magnate out of Las Vegas, Sheldon Adelson, chipped in $5 million into his super PAC, and boom, they were off and running and able to start running ads against Mitt Romney and other sort of things. So, you know, all of a sudden, one or two people can really make the difference for a candidate, and, you know, it's, I guess, we all have to come to terms with whether that's the sort of system that we want or not, but it certainly skews the playing field.
Well, Neil, the super PACs and the candidates cannot, quote-unquote, coordinate, but then when you learn more about the super PACs, they all seem to have either worked for the candidate before or have a very friendly association with the candidate. I think Stephen Colbert's super PAC is shedding some light on this kind of relationship. Do you want to weigh in on that, Neil?
Well, I mean, I was going to bring up Stephen Colbert myself. I mean, he's so brilliant in a satirical way of just exposing the idiocy of so many of these things. And, you know, so he has his super PAC, and so he then decides, well, maybe I'm going to run, so I can't be involved in my super PAC, so I'll turn my super PAC over to Jon Stewart, who, of course, you know, they're like close friends and work together at Comedy Central and all that stuff, but we don't ever communicate on this. I mean, it's been a brilliant satire of the whole thing. And, you know, now he's down here, he's a native right. South Carolinian, grew up here in Charleston. He's having a rally today for Herman Cain because all these various, you know, all nine of the sort of original folks out of the starting gate going back last spring are on the ballot here. So even Gary Johnson's on the ballot, John Huntsman, all these people. So there's a whole kind of push, sort of protest push, to see whether the others, the people that aren't actually even running anymore, can get a significant vote. And Colbert is now trying to get people to vote for Herman Cain. And but, you know, he's just great at poking fun at the process.
Let me get Dina from Huntington Valley to join our conversation. And Dina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I wanted to say, I'm going to be voting for Barack Obama. I'm a liberal Democrat. And but I did agree with, and I would never vote for Gingrich, ever, ever, ever. But I did agree with Gingrich's answer last night in the beginning to John King. And I know that, I mean, I think that a question like that, there was something wrong with that question. I mean, it was terrible. And also, I'm thinking about Clinton, too, and, you know, sometimes when these newscasters get up and with a straight face, they announce these crass things as though this is, you know, some kind of serious thing to discuss in public. I don't know. It's something terrible about it. And yet, it probably, I don't know, how is, maybe you, I would like to ask your guest,
sure.
How is it relevant? How should it be handled? Why is it important? It is important, these questions, but there's something very inappropriate about a newscaster asking, bringing up subjects like that in a serious way, when really they're just being provocative or, you know, it's for entertainment, really.
Well, you know, Dina, I appreciate, because I can hear the struggle that you're having with the issue, and it's a legitimate one. Let me see if Scott Huffman wants to respond, and then we'll get Neil King as well. And thanks for calling into the show.
You know, she made an excellent point about it. It was all for show. It was for entertainment. You know, if I could reference Neil's point about Lehrer, you could imagine Lehrer halfway through a debate saying, "Does personal character matter?" You know, and bringing it up more subtly that way. But by, you know, the opening minutes, when, you know, the only time when, you know, most people are tuned in, to start throwing around the terms open marriage, that was clearly a ratings grab. It didn't really broach the topic of, does private character matter among public servants? You know, how do you compare private activity to what they can be trusted with the public good? That could be brought up perhaps in a relevant way, but not in the sensationalistic way he did it. It sort of took the air out of the character question.
Neil King, what do you think? And what I was wondering as well is that Newt Gingrich is a candidate who has been telling people how to live their lives. And I don't know whether that allows a questioner to so directly question his life.
You know, I think that point is a relevant one, and I think if it was brought up in that sort of context, it would be a totally fair thing to do. I mean, you know, people preaching to other people about the sanctity of marriage who have had multiple marriages themselves, but they only want to approve of certain kinds of marriages, no matter how wholesome or enduring they may be. I mean, I think those are legitimate things. I do find it kind of amazing that, you know, in a more than just a public arena than that, it's about as public as you can get, that to step forward and just sort of blast somebody on what's basically, there's nothing more unseemly than the accusations of a spurned spouse from long ago. And I just kind of imagine, like, if I would have run into somebody's ex-wife at a bar and they told me something, and then the next morning I approached the guy on the street with a few people and said, you know, I was talking to your ex-wife last night, she said you wanted an open marriage. You know, it's not the kind of thing that we would do as individuals and at that sort of level. So it is kind of astonishing that it came up in the way it did. And I think in some ways Gingrich's response was very tactical and brilliantly done, but I think he very much knew viscerally that he was playing off that sentiment that the caller reflected, and I think a lot of us sort of intuitively have, that it's just not really the right place for it.
And he's very good at going after the media.
Very good at doing that, yeah. I mean, it's funny, because for so many of us in the media, John King included, all of these accusations were totally well known. I mean, she's done interviews. She did one with Esquire last year that was very long, and the only thing that was new about all of that was that it was new, that it was happening, and it was coming up that night. I mean, the idea that he was saying that a lot of voters in South Carolina were talking about this, I'm not so sure that was the case. For one, the thing hadn't even aired yet. It was airing like at midnight last night, so it was more the reporter class that was really talking about it and bringing it up with voters. I didn't encounter a lot of voters who themselves were talking about this particular issue.
I guess now they are today. Neil King, national reporter for the Wall Street Journal, has been covering the Republican presidential race. Also with us, Scott Huffman, professor of political science at Winthrop University in South Carolina. He directs the Winthrop Poll Initiative, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, talking as we do often about the Republican presidential primary, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Scott, let me go back to you and actually go back to South Carolina itself. And we know that there's a relatively high rate of unemployment. When you look at Republicans in South Carolina, who are we talking about? Who are these people that are Republicans?
Well, South Carolina's Republicans are definitely not a one-note group. In previous decades, as the South Carolina Republican Party was coming into its own and becoming dominant, you could look at the state, and our geography could predict what kind of Republican you're looking at. Down, if you look at our state and move your hand in sort of a parallel line to the coast up over, you come over first the Low Country. In the Low Country, the Charleston area, that's much more fiscal conservatism, the home of fiscal conservatism, retirees coming down from the north, bringing native Republicanism with them. They aren't converts who 30 years ago were Democrats like a lot of the original Republicans. As you move in, you'll come to the Columbia area and the Midlands. That is a mixture of fiscal conservatives and social conservatives. And in the upstate, anchored by the Greenville-Spartanburg area, is the home of social conservatives. So traditionally, that was much more of your church-going, your abortion, same-sex marriage type folks. But the broad spectrum of conservatism is represented in South Carolina. You'll find Tea Parties now everywhere, although their strength has waned since the peak in 2010. But you have to appeal to social conservatives, value voters, fiscal conservatives, veterans, military conservatives. You really have to appeal to it all. Huckabee came in 2008 thinking he could sing primarily the note that the evangelicals would hear, and that would be enough. And that was simply not the case. You cannot build a winning coalition on one group alone, although you can start a foundation on it.
Neil, you've been following this race, covering this race, what, from the get-go?
From the get-go. I've been on the road for basically the last month.
And do you know where you are as we're speaking?
Pardon me?
Do you know literally where you are this morning?
Yeah, I know. It's been a little, yeah. I'm in a hotel room in, it looks like Charleston. Yeah, this is Charleston. That's right.
but how vulnerable or would you say Mitt Romney is at this point in the race?
To temporarily vulnerable and long-term, just not so at all. I mean, the fascinating thing when you were asking, Scott, about why this is the place where a lot of negative advertising and kind of dirty tricks and things occur, one of the reasons, I think, is that this is really the last platform before things move nationally and into a much bigger stage where lesser-funded people can try to do things to get their last gasp. And leaving here, things leave the kind of cozy confines of, you know, the first three states and go on to a huge, very difficult-to-compete-in state like Florida. And, you know, you look there, and considering that we've been talking about debates, in Florida, the only thing that any of the other three candidates outside of Mitt Romney have going for them is a hope that they'll have more than one debate session and therefore get 2 hours of time on Florida television to do their thing. Because Mitt Romney has huge organization there, has been working for months to get things going, has already been advertising there for weeks, both him and his super PAC, and has just a massive advantage. And, you know, that is the case sort of looking at all the future contests down the road. So I think the whole primary right now is all about, can Newt Gingrich or maybe Rick Santorum get a really big gust of wind coming out of here to challenge him in Florida and then to continue on? And if they don't, I think it's basically over, because they just don't have the organization, the deep pockets that Romney has to prevail in the states that are coming up. And in that way, you know, South Carolina has a reputation for being determinative, and I think that's the reason that it's going to be.
And what do you think, Scott? Is how, and I know the race is tightening, but do you think Romney is vulnerable?
He's vulnerable. Whether or not he can still eke it out is another question. He may be able to here at the end eke it out, and if he does, if you know the bombast and the attacks and the surge in South Carolina for any of the Mitt Romney candidates wasn't enough to propel them ahead of him in South Carolina, it is pretty much over. But even if another candidate wins in South Carolina, as Neil pointed out, they're not likely to do well in Florida. Romney will run a lot better in Florida, and the only thing that would really be damaged is a bit of the pockets of Romney's super PAC and the reputation of South Carolina for always picking the eventual nominee. But Romney still has a good chance. You know, the 25% that he had constantly been having here in South Carolina when he was the number two candidate to a series of not Romney candidates, people thought that was a ceiling. It turned out to be a floor. And as people, you know, that was his solid base of support. And as people started filtering away from the, you know, the other candidates, they were saying, you know, he wasn't my first choice, but I don't think I want any of these other guys. And so he started picking up bit by bit and has built upon that 25% rather than it being a ceiling for him.
And we're almost out of time here. Neil, where will you be tomorrow?
I'm here in the morning, and then for logistical reasons, I'm actually going back to D.C. to sort of cover the final thing from there and marshal coverage on Sunday, which, you know, is sort of for our Monday paper. So it's more of a where can I be in a solid, non-moving state. And then off to Florida.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Neil King, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. It was real fun.
It was fun for us as well. And he's national reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Scott Huffman, as always, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Always my pleasure.
And he's a professor of political science at Winthrop University, directs the Winthrop Poll Initiative. Speaking of Florida, we have Aubrey Jewett waiting in the wings, and we'll be getting a preview of the next Republican primary. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University. The Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics is hosting Ready to Run Pennsylvania, bipartisan political training to encourage women to participate in government leadership positions. This day-long conference covers media training and fundraising. Ready to Run is Saturday, February 4th at Drexel University's McAllister Hall. Conference details and registration are available online at pcwp.org. Rhythm and blues performer, songwriter, and producer Johnny Otis has died at the age of 90. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our 1989 interview with Otis. He was a white performer who loved black culture and considered himself black by persuasion. Join us. Papa told me. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest from the campaign trail after the debates and before Saturday's Republican primary in South Carolina. Also, how two events on the same day in 1967, one a protest, one a battle in Vietnam, led to a book by David Moranis and now a dance piece. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The South Carolina Republican primary is tomorrow, Saturday, and in fact, NPR will cover the results beginning at 7 o'clock. Then the Republican primary moves next to Florida, where voters go to the polls on January 31st. Here to give us a preview is Aubrey Jewett. He's associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Central Florida, where his work focuses on Florida politics, Southern politics, and American government. And Aubrey Jewett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So we were spending a lot of time in the first part of the show talking about last night's debate. I know people in Florida watch television. How do you think that played down in Florida?
Well, I suspect it probably played like it did in much of the country. I will say that we have less social conservatives in the Republican base down here than they do in South Carolina, so that might be a good thing for Romney.
Can you describe the Republican base in Florida?
Well, yeah. Above all, particularly in this election, it's primarily made up of conservatives who are really concerned about the economy and also about the debt problem that the country faces. And in Florida, the housing market is really in crisis, so they're also quite concerned about that. As part of the overall Republican demographic in the state, we have a lot of seniors. In fact, if you rank the 50 states in a percent of the population over 65, Florida's number one. So we do have a lot of seniors and a lot of senior Republicans. We also have a lot of Hispanic Republicans, mostly Cuban, down in South Florida, and so they will be a force to be reckoned with in this primary as well.
And how does the Florida primary work?
Well, yeah, it's pretty interesting. The last 4 years ago, it was sort of odd, and this year it's going to be a little odd, too, because Florida's legislature decided we were going to jump the line and break the rules once again of the National Republican Party, and we were going to go earlier than we were supposed to. But I will say that the legislators did a little bit better job this time, particularly on the Republican side, of finding out exactly what the penalties would be. And so right now we are going to be a winner-take-all primary, but we will get about only half the delegates that we would have gotten. But it's still over 50, which is a pretty large amount of delegates, more than the first three states. And the other thing I guess that's interesting about Florida's primary is that it's a closed primary, and that's going to make it much different than Iowa and New Hampshire. You know, Iowa, of course, with a caucus state, you have a fairly small, unrepresentative sample of the most ideological people who are willing to give up many hours of their day to go and caucus and actually meet with other people and talk for hours and hours. And then in New Hampshire, of course, it's an open primary, where you have a lot of independents and Democrats who might actually vote in a Republican primary. So this is going to be a closed primary. You have to be registered as a Republican to take part, but it will be a much more wider representative sample of Republicans than you saw, say, for instance, in Iowa.
And is there interest in this race? Do you see public interest in this race?
Most definitely, on the Republican side, I think Democrats are looking with some amusement and thinking, well, Obama's not in great shape, but maybe right now the Republicans seem to be pretty frazzled, so that's giving them some hope down here that maybe Obama, might win Florida yet and get reelected. But Republicans are certainly following the race, and it'll be interesting to see, of course, what happens in South Carolina. You know, currently the polls there, as best as I can tell, show that it's very, very tight. Mm-hmm. Conversely, the polls down here over the last week to 10 days, Romney's stretched out a big lead. I mean, he basically Newt Gingrich had gone into the lead about 3-4 weeks ago, and then he sort of crashed and burned down here, and Romney's up, depending on the poll, by 15 or 20 points. But, of course, you know, who knows, once the results of South Carolina are in and the candidates come down here and even more media advertising, things could change down here as well. But right now, Romney's looking pretty good.
I noticed the president was at the Magic Kingdom yesterday in Florida.
He was, yeah. He came down to talk about tourism and some of his proposals to make it easier for tourists to visit this country. And, of course, particularly for Florida's economy, that's great news, and for Central Florida economy in particular. And trying to make it easier, particularly for South Americans and Central Americans to come and visit here, the Magic Kingdom, Universal, et cetera. So, yeah, good photo op for him, but he was saying, definitely preaching to the choir in Central Florida. We all like to hear that the federal government's going to try to make regulations easier for foreign travel, for people to come here and visit and spend their money.
You had mentioned some of the issues that Floridians care about, jobs in the economy and foreclosures. And I know Florida's been hit hard by the mortgage crisis. Just how hard?
Well, I suspect, you know, I don't want to play our violin for Florida, but I suspect we're one of the hardest hit states, certainly, you know, in the bottom 5 or 10 as far as housing market, and actually probably in the bottom 2 or 3. You know, I think Nevada's been hammered pretty well too, but you know, we often were called for a while there the Ponzi state, because for several years, as there was a big housing run up and the prices were just going up dramatically, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50% a year, and everyone just knew that was not sustainable. And basically, you know, you saw this happen in other parts of the country as well, but here, I think because for several decades we'd really already been in the housing mode, and then it really just went into overdrive. Now we have the aftermath, because prices have fallen 50% and 60% in some cases. And unfortunately, in a number of areas, it's not quite hit bottom yet. There was some thought that maybe this year things had hit bottom because the rate of foreclosure seemed to be slowing. But then a lot of the housing experts said, well, unfortunately, that's because the legal process has slowed to a crawl, because a lot of the lawyers involved and things were not basically following the law. And they said, we need to slow everything down because homeowners are getting the shaft, basically. And bottom line, what that means is we haven't hit bottom yet in the foreclosures. There's a lot of foreclosures and distressed properties still out there that haven't been cleared out. And until that happens, we're probably not going to start seeing a rebound, unfortunately.
You had mentioned the fact that Florida has a lot of seniors. I think Pennsylvania not far behind you. But I'm assuming that makes Social Security, Medicare, these are key issues for senior voters?
Yes, absolutely. I think Pennsylvania is number two, right behind Florida in percent of seniors. And we definitely have a certain agenda that seniors are concerned about, and certainly right at the top, Social Security and Medicare, but also taxes and budget. Seniors tend to want to have an orderly fiscal house. And of course, many seniors moved here because of Florida's low taxes, but generally also they want, you know, keeping national taxes as low as possible as well. You know, interestingly though, it seems as if Social Security and Medicare, as of now, have not become big issues in the campaign as yet. But we'll see what happens. I think particularly with Medicare tied to the national health care reform, you know, that some people call Obamacare,
right.
I think that, especially as we get into the general election, will become a bigger issue here in Florida, because a lot of seniors are worried that with the big health care reform, Medicare is actually going to be hurt by that, and so they're real concerned about that down here in Florida. I don't know if that's true, by the way, but that seems to be the general consensus, that seniors are worried that might be the case.
That's what people fear, and that's Aubrey Jewett. He's associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Central Florida, giving us a preview of the upcoming primary in Florida on January 31st. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Aubrey, I noticed that Florida also has early voting. When does that voting begin?
It actually will begin this coming weekend. And so people are going to start voting, very soon. And Floridians have really taken a shine to early voting or convenience voting, as some people call it. And it's made the campaigns down here have to really start thinking a little more strategically and preparing early, saying, you know, we've got to contact voters earlier, and we've got to be ready that a lot of people are going to make decisions. At the same time, though, you can't take it for granted that everybody's going to vote early, because there are still a lot of people that are going to vote on quote-unquote election day, you know, the 31st. And so you've got to come down and continue to try to get those undecided voters and get them to the polls as well. I think overall, once again for Mitt Romney, it's probably good news, because of all the Republican candidates, he has the best organization in the state and the most money, and they've been working quite a while on absentee ballot drives among Republican voters, for instance, and just reminding people about early voting starting. And so, you know, that's, again, a plus for the Romney people because of their money and organization they have. And it's just something, you know, Gingrich has some money, but more it's a Santorum problem, because he just doesn't have very much. He certainly was able to raise some after Iowa, but he it just doesn't compare. And he almost has no organization, formal organization, down here in Florida.
And what kind of influence do Rick Scott, Marco Rubio, what kind of influence do they have in Florida when it comes to the candidates and the voters?
Well, I think Marco Rubio will certainly have some influence, particularly among South Florida Cubans. And, in fact, several members of our congressional delegation who are Cubans from South Florida, they've already come out for Mitt Romney. So they're sort of sending a signal to the Cuban voters that they think that Romney is the best choice. And it's been a little bit uncomfortable at times with the Cuban Hispanic vote and their support of Romney, because Romney has been one of the toughest on illegal immigration. And so, for instance, Mario Diaz-Balart and Eliana Rose Leighton, who have both come out for Romney, have said, well, you know, well, we support Romney and most of his positions. We think he's, you know, off base on this immigration. We're going to work with him on that. But we do agree that, you know, on most of the issues. So that's why we're supporting him. For Governor Scott, I'm not sure. I think he still has some influence with the Tea Party movement here in Florida. They certainly were very helpful in getting him elected in the first place. But his popularity ratings, even among Republicans, it's just not great right now. So I don't know that he's got a lot of influence, even in a Republican primary. Not probably as much as our former Governor Crist had 4 years ago, when just a couple days before the primary, he finally came out for McCain. And some people said, well, that probably helped McCain, for at least for a few percentage points anyway.
And do you see and hear the money being spent on ads in Florida, whether radio or television?
Yeah, we have begun to see some ads over the last, say, 10 days. They've mostly either been run by Mitt Romney, sort of get-to-know-you ads about, you know, I'm Mitt Romney, I've been married to the same woman for 40 years and worked, you know, three jobs and saved the Olympics and that sort of thing. And then there's been some negative ads run about Santorum and Gingrich, which I assume, you know, when you read the fine print, I don't think those were paid for by Romney himself, but it was paid by the super PACs that are supporting Romney. Other than that, I haven't seen too much. As I said, Santorum doesn't have all that much money. Gingrich has some, and I suspect we're going to see some more ads from him, or at least from the super PAC that's supporting him. And Ron Paul, you know, have not seen too much from him in Florida, although he's polling about 9 or 10% down here.
What about Jewish voters in Florida? Obviously not a monolith, but what kind of influence or what issues do they care about?
Sure. Well, you know, in Jewish voters, there are some Jewish Republicans in Florida. Probably maybe 30% of the Jewish population is Republican. They're more strongly Democrat, as they are, you know, across the country. I think in the Republican primary, they're probably most interested in the economy, just like all other voters. That's just such a dominant issue. But certainly interested in support of Israel is a big one. And I think in the general election, we'll see a more concerted effort by Republicans to try to peel some of Democratic-leaning Jewish voters away from Obama, basically saying, you know, trying to make the case that Obama has not been as strong in the Middle East and has not been as strong a supporter of Israel, and that the Republican candidate would be better on those issues.
Let me see if I can squeeze a caller on before we have to say goodbye.
Sure.
We've got Paul from Center City joining us. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Sure.
I was reading this World Health Organization report about how in countries where abortion is highly restricted, there are actually more abortions and more women die because they're done poorly. And I just wonder if that information is in the Latino community, the Cuban community, I beg your pardon, in Florida, if there's any relevance there and how that plays. Thanks.
Have you looked at that, Aubrey?
Well, I haven't looked at that, you know, particular piece of information that the caller mentioned. I can say that on average within the, I think he's right that abortion does tend to be an important issue within the Hispanic community, at least in most elections, and Puerto Rican and Cuban voters down here do tend to be pro-life because they're more religious, either Catholic or actually one of the faster growing faiths among Hispanic is evangelical. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, in this particular election and in this Republican primary, the abortion and some of the other social issues are not going to be as important or salient down here to most of those Florida voters. They're just so concerned about the economy and jobs. And I guess also, bottom line, electability, right? Who they think can beat, has the best chance to beat President Obama. That's a big thing in voters' minds down here as well.
And we're out of time here. And Obama won Florida, but just by a couple of percentage points.
Yes, Florida was definitely, it lived up to his reputation as a swing state because Obama won, but not by much. And, of course, George W. Bush won before that. So I suspect we'll live up to our purple state reputation coming up again.
Well, Aubrey Jewett, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And he's associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Central Florida, rounding out our trio of guests in this first hour of Radio Times, talking about the Republican presidential primary. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives and podcasts. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.